Okay. First, an announcement. I'll point out that on the class webpage, it said that homework number 7 is due on Friday, the 2nd of December. And now on the class webpage, it also says that on the homework, but it didn't previously say that. So it's Friday, December 2nd, so I just changed that. It used to say December 9th. I'll give you the names of who pointed that out to me in discussion section this morning, and you can beat them up. But yes, it's this Friday is when it's due. This Friday. You will have another homework handed out this Friday that will be due Friday the 9th. For those of you who wanted to, I suppose, the homework that I assigned this Friday, you could hand in this Friday and still hand in the homework 7. On average, I could keep it that you were out getting a week to work the homeworks, but we'll just give you a week to work the homeworks. Other questions? I will be sending out an email. I do now have a room for where we will meet Wednesday afternoon. It's up on the 7th floor. I can't remember whether it's 7:33 or 7:39, but it's one of the two. Yes?
Are those sessions going to be recorded?
I will try to record them, yes. No, you know, the trouble with the recordings is you won't hear the questions because there will be some element of discussion. But there will be some that will be actually some general comments that I will make that will be there. So, again, we'll be doing the beta carotene data set at 3:30 and at 4:30 be doing the audiology data set. Other questions? Okay, well, we were talking about how we most often compare two groups with respect to time to event, the distribution of time to event, when we have right censored data. So we've already talked about how you would compare Kaplan-Meier estimates, which are just the censored data way to compare binomial proportions when you've dichotomized the data. But when we're trying to look at something that uses all of the range without dichotomizing the data, what we use most often is the hazard function. Hazard is the instantaneous risk. And as you remember from the estimate of the Kaplan-Meier that was also based on estimating the hazard at each time, it looked like a binomial proportion, the number of deaths over that time divided by the number who were at risk. Now, interestingly enough, while we do use the hazard as most often the basis of our comparison of two groups, we rarely estimate it. We instead just estimate the comparison of the two. So we usually estimate a hazard ratio, also referred to as a relative risk, and it's an instantaneous risk. It's not a cumulative risk. So it's at each second, what is the probability that you will die in the next nanosecond. Okay, that's what a hazard is. So conditional upon still being at risk, what's the probability that you die in the next second or two? Now, we do this, a comparison of hazard ratios, in a stratified analysis. When we're interested in comparing groups within strata, it's usually because there is confounding or interactions, or there's also precision. But in this idea within strata, in the presence of confounding, comparisons within strata are all similar, but failure to stratify results in a comparison that is misleading due to bias. And as I've remarked many times, there are nuances here. Many of you are going to learn in other courses that says, if there's confounding, your unadjusted analysis gives a different answer than the adjusted analysis. That's not entirely true. When we're looking at means or geometric means, that is true. But for odds or hazards, that's not true. So just the fact that you get a different answer when you do an adjusted or unadjusted analysis does not prove that there's confounding. But in stratified analyses, when we say that there is pure confounding, we do regard that the estimates we would get within every stratum is the same. In interactions, the comparisons within strata result in different estimates. And as we've also talked, sometimes there are interactions and we don't care about them. We just average across them anyway. And so then we still would be interested in confounding. We remove confounding by adjusting for the confounder using a stratified test statistic. Adjustment for a covariate means making comparisons between subjects who have similar levels of that covariate. Now, we've talked in discussion section about using the FEV data, where our goal was to compare smoking children to non-smokers of the same age and height. And then if we could estimate that within every combination of age and height, we'd estimate the differences in those strata, and then we'd average those differences. Of course, in the FEV data set, we had too much sparse data. We had too many strata that we didn't have enough smokers or didn't have enough non-smokers. And so we were going to do linear regression sorts of adjustment to adjust for the general trends, to try to borrow information. But sometimes we do have enough data in all of the strata, and we just do a straight out adjustment. Adjustment for a covariate does not remove interactions. Interactions mean that the question has different answers in different strata. The adjustment for the covariate will merely average the effect across strata. And usually we do a weighted average instead of a straight out average. We weight different strata according to the sample size in each strata. So stratified estimates are obtained by combining estimates from each independent stratum. It's generally best to average the estimates, sometimes weighted, rather than averaging the z-scores. And the standard errors for the stratified estimates are obtained using the properties of independent random variables that we've already talked about. For instance, were we wanting to look at the effect of hepatomegaly on survival after adjustment for sex, where we were summarizing our response by five-year survival. And in this case, we didn't have censored data, because in this data set, we had, we do have censored data. So for each sex, we would compute the difference in survival across hepatomegaly groups using the Kaplan-Meier estimates that we've done before. And then our adjusted measure effect would compute the average difference between those hepatomegaly effects. And this would be all of the algebra, that we'd find some estimate in the males for what the difference in survival was between hepatomegaly and no hepatomegaly. And then we'd do the same for the females. So our theta hat might be the five-year survival estimate from Kaplan-Meier. And we would have gotten the standard error from Greenwood's formula. And then our weighted average is we would take the difference between the males, hepatomegaly and no hepatomegaly groups, and then we'd multiply by P, which would be the proportion of males. Now, in the general population, the logical choice for that P would be 50%. Why not? But in primary biliary cirrhosis, where 90% of patients with primary biliary cirrhosis are women, maybe a better average would be to put 10% on the male's effect and 90% on the female's effect. So we can let science enter into it by its importance rather than just the sample size. I might have done a study where I purposely got 50% males and 50% females, but that wouldn't be representative of what was really happening in the general population. I could convert it back to something that mattered to me. Of course, this is just sample survey numbers. And the approximate distribution, well, we would just combine these values. And it's not exactly pretty, but it's not a difficult thing to do. We take the standard errors, we square them, we add them up, and then we take the square root. Notice that I do take p squared and 1 minus p squared because we know that the variance of a constant times a random variable is that constant squared times the variance of a random variable. So this is something that sometimes I do when I'm just reading the literature, that they haven't given me a stratified estimate that I wish I had. The Mantel-Hansel statistic is generally regarded as the best choice of methods for comparing binary data. So not when there is no censoring. We would use this to estimate adjusted odds ratios. And as we've talked before, one advantage of the odds is that there's probably scientifically a more rational chance that we would not have effect modification on the odds than there would be on proportions. There are other methods based on the distribution of the log odds. Next quarter, as you do more into logistic regression, some of these methods would correspond to that. Okay, now, the log rank test. Well, we've talked about how the hazard looks like binomial proportions. So what would happen if, with our censored data, we decided to adjust for the length of follow-up? So I'm trying to estimate the odds of a man dying versus a woman dying. But we recognize that those odds will depend upon how long we followed them. So the odds of a male dying is way higher than the odds of a female dying at birth. Okay, that boys have a higher infant mortality. And then it's also higher when they're 16. And, you know, the males have a higher mortality. In fact, my favorite genetic disease is cars and guns because they're far more dangerous to males than they are to females. And there's a genetic difference between males and females. But the idea is we look at those odds at different times, but the chance, what the odds are of dying is far different at birth or at 16 or at 70. And so what we'd like to do is estimate the odds ratio of dying in the next nanosecond at all those different times where we stratify on how long we've been watching people. So the data are stratified by the time of event. Often there is only a single event observed in each strata. But who we're using is all of the people who are at risk. Non-informative censoring says it's okay to use the same people in lots of different strata. You can use me, as I was at risk when I was 10 years old. I was also at risk when I was 15 years old. I was also at risk when I was 40 years old. And I'm not at risk when you start considering 70 years old. Okay? I haven't gotten there that far. You can use my data over and over and over again in all those different strata, because by non-informative censoring, the only reason why I would not be in a particular risk group was selecting people based on a random sample of who was at risk. So it's okay to use the repeat measurements here. Non-informative censoring says that it's asymptotically uncorrelated. So that's the key assumption of non-informative censoring, is that if I'm still at risk, I have to look like I'm drawn from the random sample of everybody who's at risk. So the same subjects are used in several different strata. Non-informative censoring argues that the estimates are independent across the strata in large samples. Equal hazard functions implies equal distributions. So if I know that the hazards are equal everywhere, then I know that the distribution of time to event is exactly the same. So the p-value is interpretable as a test that the survival distributions are similar for the two groups. This test is most powerful when the true alternative is proportional hazards, a constant risk ratio over time. And then proportional hazards regression will provide estimates of that risk ratio. So what's the proportional hazards model? It says that as one group's risk changes over time, again, think back to the bathtub shape of the hazard for the human experience. At birth, you're at a relatively high risk of dying in the next nanosecond. That risk decreases over the first few years, so until you get past the infant mortality range. Then it stays flat for a while, and then the risk goes up on into teenage years due to accidents and gunfights, and then chronic disease starts taking you out later, right? Well, if there's proportional hazards, no matter what the risk is for females, the males is a certain multiple of that risk. And to take into its extreme, if we assumed the proportional hazards assumption, then when a female goes hang gliding, the male's risk goes up too by some amount, right? But it's this concept that there's a constant proportionality in the odds of dying in the next nanosecond. To get the log rank test out of Stata, well, after you've set up your variable, you do STS test, and you put in your grouping variable, comma, and you type log rank. That is the default, so you don't really have to type log rank. The p-value is based on a chi-squared statistic. It is related to the Mantel-Hansel chi-square statistic, but it won't be called that. Just be the log rank statistic. It gives a p-value that's two-sided. So, for instance, using the PSA data set, looking for a difference in the hazard of survival among groups who have a bone scan score of 3 versus those who have a bone scan score of 1 or 2. This would be the output from STS test BSS3. And really, the only thing that's of very much value here is to go down to the p-value where it tells you it's 0.004. So based on the two-sided p-value of 0.004, we reject the null hypothesis of equal relapse-free survival probabilities between the bone scan score groups. This is averaged over all time, for all the time that we have people available. So it's not at any particular time. If you believe the proportional hazard assumption, it's at every particular time. Because the expected events are less than the observed in the BSS equals 3 group, we can presume that the higher BSS is associated with worse relapse-free survival. The log rank test does not give estimates. However, it's closely related to proportional hazards regression, also called Cox regression. It provides estimates of the average hazard ratio over time. Groups with higher hazards have higher event rates. So a hazard ratio greater than 1 is worse survival. Of course, it depends upon what is that good or bad, right? Well, if it's time to death, you don't like having a high hazard. But as I've remarked before, survival analysis has been used in sex discrimination where you look at time to promotion. And there, women and minorities have better survival. And that's not as good. The hazard ratio estimates are approximately normal in large samples. You just say ST Cox. You put your grouping variable. And I do tend to use the robust command here, too. It removes the dependency of the variance estimates on the proportional hazards assumption. Gives a hazard ratio and a 95% confidence interval. These are computed on the log hazard ratio scale, just like when we did geometric means, how we got confidence intervals on the log scale, and then we had to exponentiate. But Stata will actually give these back to you on the right scale. So p-values, it'll give you a Wald test, which is based on approximately normal estimate. That's the sort of test we've been doing all along of the estimate minus the hypothesis divided by the standard error. There's also the likelihood ratio test. There's also a score test. Data does not give that to you, but it would be the log rank test. So the score test from proportional hazards regression is the log rank test. So using the PSA survival by BSS, we did ST Cox. This, notice that this is a dichotomous predictor here. BSS3 is 1 or 0. As we've talked in discussion session, you can do regression with binary predictors. And this tells us that the hazard ratio was 2.96 with a 95% confidence interval from 1.42 to 6.16. Notice that the p-value of 0.004 in this case, that walled statistics p-value, is the same as the score statistic p-value. In large samples, those statistics do all agree. In small samples, they can disagree. So you usually decide which of the p-values you're going to quote. Most often, people quote the log rank statistic, just like in the binary world where we tend to quote the chi-square statistic and then compute the confidence interval a different way. We do that here, too. So interpretation, at any given time, the risk of relapse in men with BSS equals 3 tends to be 2.96 times that of men with a lower BSS. The 95% confidence interval suggests that these results are typical if the true risk of relapse is 1.42 to 6.16 times that in men with lower BSS, and based on a p-value of 0.004, we reject the null. If they had differed in this, I would have added based on the log rank p-value. You'd make clear which test you were using. We can also, in parametric models, compare quantiles. So there are times that inference for censored data is based on assumptions about the shape of the distribution. These are usually called accelerated failure time models. We assume a constant ratio between groups for all quantiles. The most famous of accelerated failure time assumptions is that of dog years, where you just multiply a dog's age by 7, and you're supposed to be able to come up with the equivalent survival probabilities. Those don't really work too well, but that's the same concept. That the idea of saying you're aging too fast or aging more slowly. Commonly used parametric models include the exponential, a constant hazard ratio independent of the past. We've talked about the ludicrousness of this assumption for long periods of time, but over periods of time, it doesn't do so badly. The Weibull, there is a theoretical derivation, first failure in a series of components that you fail as soon as the weakest link in a chain fails. The log hazard is linear in log time. Exponential is a special case. And this is the only accelerated failure time model that's also proportional hazards. This is where what I use to justify why the proportional hazards model tends to work fairly well for us, even when the proportional hazards assumption is unlikely to be true. But over a short period of time, the idea that your hazard function might be well approximated by a straight line on the log-log scale, then that argues that the Weibull is probably a fairly reasonable approximation. And since the Weibull is proportional hazards, then proportional hazards is reasonably robust. I'll say that 25 years ago, 30 years ago, now when the proportional hazards model was first described, well, it's almost 40 years that it was first described. 30 years ago, they proved its asymptotics. Everybody spent an awful lot of time worrying about whether the proportional hazards assumption was true. And now nobody worries about that as much. It behaves fairly well. We understand better now when it doesn't. So usually in biomedicine, we do not use these parametric models very much. In engineering, they are used, the Weibull in particular. There are other ones, the gamma, the log normal, many other generalizations. I use the log normal as a case in point of my statement about it's not normality of the data that we care about. The log normal model is not particularly robust. because the estimator that we get out of it is not the sample mean anymore. Whereas if we didn't have censored data, the estimator that we have for the log geometric mean is the sample mean. So that's very robust. But once we have censored data, it's not very robust. So again, in biomedicine, we don't tend to use these parametric models very often. Some caveats, choice of summary measures. All of the parametric models are sensitive to violation of the distributional assumptions. They assume constant ratio of all quantiles. We don't have robustness to other distributions in any particular model, including the log normal. Semi-parametric models, we do know how to use the proportional hazards model even when the hazard ratio is not constant, but you need to be careful. It may not estimate anything that you care about. Okay, so this is my proof of why we don't care as much about the hazard ratio sometimes. I'm going to consider survival with a particular treatment used in renal dialysis patients, and I'm going to use observational data. And I'm going to do something that we do quite often in such registries. Because the quality of data changes over time, I'm only going to use data gathered after 1995. I'm imagining that after 1995, they started more rigorously collecting the data that I wanted. However, I'm also pretending that after 1995, treatment practices changed. That prior to that time, there was more of a tendency for people to use either what I call the treat with a control. But after that time, people started using one or the other more rigorously. So if I'm trying to fake what a clinical trial might have shown, if only they'd been randomized, I want to take cases who were treated earlier. So I'm going to have something that's called left entry. So I'm going to take everybody who was diagnosed in 1995, and I'm going to follow them for 8 years. But of those cases who were diagnosed before 1995, so take, for instance, the people who were diagnosed in 1994, I'm not going to use the data from 94 to 95, but then I'll start using the data for the next years. Okay. This is equivalent to if we started doing survival right now and tried to define the survival for the entire age cohort, well, you know that I didn't die prior to now, so I would be left entry. But you wouldn't have me in this set among, well, let's say 25-year-olds, because I'm not now 25 and you don't know what that idea is. You're only going to use me from this point forward. That's called left entry. Left entry. So I'm going to do that. How do we analyze this data? I could take survival at a fixed point in time. I could take median and other quantiles. I could take the mean, if my survival estimate goes all the way down to zero, or the restricted mean, if not. Or I could take the hazard ratio, or a weighted average of the hazard ratio over time is really what's happening. And I could use parametric, semi-parametric, or non-parametric methods. So this is all hypothetical data on 5,623 subjects. Kaplan-Meier curves for survival. Which group would you rather be in? Treatment. Okay. So now the question is, who wants to be a millionaire? The proportional hazards analysis estimates a treatment to control hazard ratio. And recall that a hazard greater than 1 is usually associated with a higher risk than the other group. So I'm giving you the p-value that comes from this analysis. It is 0.0018 on this data. So that is the log rank test's p-value. My question is, what's the hazard ratio? 2.07, that the treatment group is twice as likely to die on average at any given time. It's 13% more likely, 13% less likely, or only half as likely to die as the control group. You have the usual lifelines. You can ask the audience, but I already have. You're the audience. I presume none of you have any friends, so we don't have to go there. So I'll go to 50-50 and eliminate two. And which two should I eliminate? Well, I should eliminate the two that you already know aren't there. Okay. So which two should I eliminate?
A and D.
Yeah, you would think so. But I'm going to eliminate A and D because with this sample size, if the hazard ratio were that high, it would be far more statistically significant. So the statistical significance of a hazard ratio is related to the number of events. And basically, that's all. Randomization ratio and number of events. I can do a very quick, I can do elevator statistics on hazard ratios if you give me the number of events. So, treatment group, 13% more likely to die, 13% less likely to die. And the truth here is Cox proportional hazards estimates it's 13% more likely to die. Okay, so you may not always want to use the hazard ratio in this setting that has clearly non-proportional hazards and a very screwy sampling scheme. Okay, so I made a very screwy sampling scheme. But hazards, how do you read the hazard off of a survival plot? We've talked before about all the different things we could say. The reason why we like treatment better than control is because, well, it's always higher than the other. We look at the vertical separation, right? And that's what we do when we use a Kaplan-Meier estimate. Or we could have looked at the horizontal difference. I could have looked at, say, the 60th percentile and looked at it and say, gee, it's earlier for the control group than the treatment. I could look at the horizontal difference between two survival curves. We've talked about another one. What's that? Pardon?
The area.
And what's the area? The area between the two curves. The difference in the means. Or in this case, since our survival curve doesn't go all the way down, I would say the 14-year restricted mean is the area between there. Okay, there's another thing we could look at. Notice that we haven't yet hit the hazard. And where do we hit the hazard? What's the hazard? It's the instantaneous risk, okay? The slope. The slope of the survival curve. And it's not just the slope. It's actually the slope divided by the survival. So the hazard function at 4 years would be the slope divided by the survival at 4 years. Okay? But you're just comparing those slopes with the idea that a survival curve that has a steeper slope must not be doing as well. That sounds great, except for the slope is constantly changing. So you have to take a weighted average of those slopes. And the weighting for the proportional hazards model is weighting by the number at risk. And in that screwy left entry that I did, I made it so that I have more data. I have more data over here where the treatment group slope is steeper and the control group is starting to level off. I don't have as much data up here where the treatment group's hazard was very level and the control group was down. Censoring distribution will change your estimate of the hazard ratio if you don't have proportional hazards. We don't have proportional hazards here. So that's something that you have to learn to understand with doing proportional hazards analysis. We still do it. It correctly told us there's a difference in these curves. I was not at all happy with the estimate it gave because I happen to like that being on treatment better than being on control. But that estimate suggested that where we had most of our data, the treatment group was doing worse in the sense of the interest. Carly?
What would be the difference between
proportional hazards, they should separate and continue separating until they, you know, until they all go to zero. But that there should be this constant slope over that. Well, that would be exponential, would be a constant slope, but a similar difference in the slopes, a similar ratio in the slopes between time. So all I can say is they should not come back together to have proportional hazards. So when you do see them coming together, or even crossing, they can cross, then that's a sign that you don't have proportional hazards. That doesn't stop us from using the log rank test a whole lot. And by the way, this could not show up in a randomized clinical trial. In a randomized clinical trial, I will always have a higher risk group, a larger risk group, at the start of my study than I do later. But in observational analyses or with time-varying covariates, which you'll talk about next quarter, you can get these strange behaviors. So I tend to regard that the mean, the median, or the proportion at some time period are far better understood, although the hazard ratio is what we tend to use most often. Questions? Yes.
So the
yes.
How did that manifest in terms of like the actual data that you were using?
Yeah. What happened is over at the left part of this curve. I guess I can get there faster than this. At this left part of the curve, I started out where I had 1,000 people in each group. Okay, a certain number die in the first year. But after that year, I had that left entry people, that the people who've been diagnosed a year ago and were still surviving, I had 950. So now I had 1,950 to follow the second year. And then so on. Then I got another 800 or so. So now I was up to 2,700. And so actually, if you look at the number at risk, which I just did not include that picture here, but later when I do proportional hazards, you see that thing when we do the simple regression. I had more people at risk over here in my sample, not really in the population, but in the sample. So that put more weight there. So people will sometimes do inverse probability of censoring weighting to remove the effect of censoring. Because you don't like censoring to mess you up. You know, that censoring, that's just because I got lazy. I just didn't follow people all the time. That's nothing scientific there. So just recognize that two people doing proportional hazards regression, if you use a different censoring thing and you have non-proportional hazards, you'll get different answers. For those of you in epidemiology, what is this akin to? Directly standardized rates. Okay, just how when you're doing direct standardization of rates, how it matters what population you standardize to. This is the same sort of thing, but the censoring is determining the population we're standardizing to. Other questions? Okay, so we've talked about the mean, we've talked about geometric mean, we've talked about proportions, we've talked about odds, we've talked about hazards, and that gets us through most of everything that we ever do. However, there are other things that we do. So again, want to talk about the general setting, and then what if we wanted to do inference about medians in a distribution-free sense? So talked about the medians if you did these parametric regression models. We don't do them very often. We can do tests about medians in a distribution-free sense, and then there's the Wilcoxon rank sum test. So again, scientific questions addressed using statistics. We quantify the distribution of a random variable in population. We find the association between two random variables, perhaps adjusting for other variables, where we look at the difference in association between two variables across subgroups. Those are effect modifications. These are the ones that we are most often doing. Of course, we had, these are the questions 3 and 4. We had questions about clustering data, clustering variables, or predicting individual observations, but those aren't used as much. certainly not in this class. We detect associations where no association is independence between two variables. And the mathematical definition is they're independent if for every choice of constants A and B, the probability that X is less than or equal to A and Y is less than or equal to B is just the product of those probabilities. And this is too big a definition. There's too many choices of A and B to check. Most often, we compare distributions across groups by choosing sample size within groups defined by one variable. So we do cohort studies or case control studies. Interventions are, of course, a special case of cohort studies. But even in cross-sectional studies, where we could try to answer that big question, it's usually easier to think about comparing the groups. So we compare conditional distributions. The distribution of X does not differ as Y varies, or the distribution of Y does not differ as X varies. Either one of these are equivalent to statistical independence of random variables. But again, as I define all of these A's and B's, there's too many ways I could have chosen those values. There's only one way that two distributions can be the same. The difference between the distribution functions are zero at every single point. There's an infinite number of ways that two distributions can differ. There's an infinite number of places to differ, and there's an infinite number of differences that there can be. To make it more manageable, we compare parameters. If some summary measure, like the mean or the median, is different for two distributions, then the distributions must be different. Scientific questions typically answered by making inference about some population parameter. The mean is most popular. Geometric mean shows up very often in biomedicine. But we could have compared the median. We could dichotomize our data, or maybe our data is already dichotomized, and look at the proportion above a threshold. That's just another mean. We could look at the odds above a threshold. We could look at the hazard. Our measure of association is then to look at the difference or the ratio of these parameters. Most often we look at the difference of means. We've looked a little bit at trying to do ratios. Most often we look at the ratio of geometric means. I've never seen anybody take the difference of geometric means. Those accelerated failure time models, most often we think of as looking at the ratio of medians. But in the two sample tests, we're going to talk about doing difference of medians. We look at difference of proportions. Sometimes we model the risk ratio. Odds, we almost always compare on the ratio level. And the hazard ratio is what we use most often. I'll just note that if you were in a two-sample setting where you wanted to assume exponential data, we might look at a difference there. But usually we look at a ratio for hazards. Sometimes a measure of association is based on a summary of bivariate distributions. The mean ratio of observations that you had to do on your last homework, which we found out to be a less desirable thing to do, right? Why? Made a difference as to whether we looked at the mean of y over x or x over y. We didn't get the same inference that the mean of y over x was not 1 over the mean of x over y. And so that meant that two people taking the same data set saying, I'm going to look at the mean of each person's response on aspirin to their response on placebo. And another person said, no, I'm going to look at the mean of their response on placebo to their response on aspirin, can get different answers. They could get different people, use different precision, different scientific conclusions about the difference between the groups. Same is true of median difference of observations. And we could also look at the probability that a randomly chosen observation from one group might exceed one chosen from the other group. Okay, so all of these things are bivariate summary measures. They're not describing one group, describing the other group, and then combining them. They are describing the two groups together all at once. Using summary measures to detect associations does require caution when interpreting results. Lack of a difference between population parameters for two distributions does not necessarily imply that the entire distributions are the same. In these comparisons, I show you lots of different distributions. We'll note that in the top row, and then in the lower right-hand corner, all of those distributions have a mean of 5. So if we did a t-test comparing the means, and a t-test that allowed for inequality of variances, we would expect that t-test to only be significant 5% of the time, because the null hypothesis that the means are equal is true. But the two distributions are not equal. So one approach is to take the medians, because across the top row, even though the means are the same, the medians are different. But then down at the bottom, the medians, the same as up in the left-hand corner. And again, down at the bottom left, we have the median being equal to 5. So this is a sucker's game. You tell me what you're going to look at, and I can find a way to cheat. Okay, I've remarked before in the salary data set, you know, when I do that in discussion section, the first thing I do is I get people to tell me what statistic they're going to use to compare the salaries of men and women, and then I tell you how I'm going to discriminate against women and that you won't detect it. Because I can always do that. Anytime we reduce things to a single measurement, we're not going to capture everything about the entire distribution. We live with it. Interpreting negative results, therefore, if we fail to detect a difference between population parameters, it might just be that the two distributions are the same. Maybe the two distributions are different, but the population parameters that we checked on were the same. And maybe the true value of the population parameters are different, but I just didn't have enough precision. So it's therefore important to choose parameters that capture some scientifically important differences, that capture differences that will likely exist and can be measured with statistical precision. And this is the order of importance. Do not go after what is statistically most precise first. It's ridiculous to have precision to answer a meaningless question. Make certain you're answering the meaningful question first. Of course, we have to use confirmatory trials in the regulatory world for something that was pointed out by Daryl Zero. We choose a primary endpoint because when you go looking for something specific, your chances of finding it are very bad because you're only looking for one of them. But when you go looking for anything at all, your chances of finding it are very good. Because of all the things in the world, you're sure to find some of them. Of course, Daryl Zero, who was the modernization of Sherlock Holmes, as played by Bill Pullman, wasn't the statistician, because if he were a statistician, he would have said it this way. Say, go looking for something specific, your chances of finding a spurious association by chance are very bad. But if you go looking for anything at all, you're going to find a spurious associated chance. Real-life examples. Observational studies showed a high risk of death in those patients who had an arrhythmia after an MI, but when we did a clinical trial on some specific antiarrhythmics, actually it stopped the arrhythmias but killed the patients. Beta-carotene on lung cancer and survival. Observational studies, high dietary beta-carotene has lower cancer incidence and longer survival. In the CARROT study, a large trial looking at a supplementation of beta-carotene in smokers, it led to higher lung cancer incidence and lower survival. So why am I making you analyze this data set on beta-carotene prevention? Yeah, okay. And effects of hormone therapy on cardiac events, observational studies. Hormone therapy has lower cardiac morbidity and mortality.
but in the Women's Health Initiative, hormone therapy in postmenopausal women leads to higher cardiac mortality. So we'll pick up here next time.